Mr. Seutinger.
Good evening. When the General Assembly of the United Nations meets on Tuesday, it will be faced with a great number of highly controversial problems, but none more controversial than the problem of Palestine. The special committee to study the problem, the first of its kind to be appointed by the Assembly, has published its full report as well as a minority report. Represented on the committee were 11 nations, but none of the big four, none of the nations most directly interested in the struggle for power in the Middle East. The problem was voluntarily referred to the Assembly by Great Britain, the mandatory power, but with the understanding that it is not obliged to accept the findings if they are contrary to Britain's interests. Yet the British would seem to be as anxious as anybody to end the mandate, which has brought them little but trouble and opprobrium over the past 25 years. And surrender of the mandate is the most important item on which the UN committee agreed unanimously. Britain is to give up the mandate within 2 years. The most important dictum of the majority is partition, division into a Jewish and Arab state, a judgment of Solomon in the eyes of the extreme Zionists, and of course the Arabs too. But moderate Jewish opinion is jubilant because the report is a victory for the principle of the Jewish homeland, which Zionism has always interpreted as meaning a Jewish state. Now, the idea of partition is by no means new. It was first recommended by a British official group, the Peel Commission, 10 years ago. It was again put forward by the British last year, after both Arabs and Zionists had boycotted the Round Table Conference. But none of the partition plans won the approval of the two Palestine factions. The Arabs denounced the whole idea, and the Jews weren't satisfied with the proposed boundaries. Actually, these boundaries weren't very different from those proposed by the UN committee now, except that the British wanted to keep the southern desert area, the Negev, for themselves as a strategic area being close to the Suez Canal. The UN committee gives it to the Jews, along with the Mediterranean coastal strip, the plain of Esdraelon, and eastern Galilee, altogether about 60% of the country. The Arabs would have the central hilly region, western Galilee, and about 40 miles of very narrow coastal strip in the south. They would have none of the major ports, not even Jaffa, which is almost wholly an Arab city. Jerusalem, by the way, would be neither Jewish nor Arab, being administered as a trusteeship by the United Nations. Jerusalem, after all, is the holy city to Christians, Arabs, and Jews. As to population, the Jewish state would have a slight Jewish majority, 500,000 Jews and over 400,000 Arabs. But the Arab state would be nearly all Arab, with only 8,000 Jews. Thus, the Jewish state would have a formidable minority problem on its hands. But that is obviously due to the fact that the committee is giving it as much land as possible and yet produce a Jewish majority. Yet 6,000-odd square miles isn't much to raise a nation on. It's not much more than the state of Connecticut, and most of it is still desert. It already contains about 1 million people, and almost 200,000 Jewish displaced persons are still in Europe, all presumably hoping to get to Palestine. But if the report is adopted, immigration will obviously become the responsibility and the headache of the future Jewish state. However, the report does recommend the entry of 150,000 displaced persons during the interim period, in other words, while the British are still in control. Considering the happenings of recent months, the prospect for the 2 years is not reassuring. We shall hear a great deal of heated argument at Lake Success, and it would be a miracle to see us, the British, and Soviet Russia agree. Incidentally, the report warns that in the case of its adoption, the UN must provide an adequate force to keep the peace in Palestine. And this is the most ominous sentence in the report, if you consider the open threat of the Arabs that they will oppose the proposed Jewish state by all the means at their command, including force. The Arabs, of course, continue to assert that Palestine is their country by virtue of 12 centuries of continuous occupation, and that the Jews are intruders belonging to and supported by an alien civilization of the West. And when I said that the Jews are jubilant, I didn't mean the extremists. The people who claim that not only Palestine, but Transjordan is theirs on biblical grounds, and say that the British are enemy soldiers on the soil of Eretz Israel. What would happen if there were no neutral force to keep the peace is not hard to imagine. For we have seen in other parts of the world what even backward and ill-equipped peoples can do when animated by religious or nationalistic fanaticism. The Arabs, it is true, are economically and technically backward, but they have behind them the populations of 7 states of the Arab League, with a population of 38 million. What we are seeing in the Middle East today is the birth of 2 new and fanatical nationalisms, that of the Arabs and that of the Palestine Jews. The British may not have foreseen this development when their armies, supported by Arab bands, liberated this area from the Turkish Empire in World War I. But they are very conscious of it today. Nor could they have foreseen the rise of Hitler in Germany, which loosed new and most terrible anti-Semitism upon the world. But people returning from England lately say that the British are so elated over their solution of the Indian problem that even Palestine no longer seems as hopeless as it did. Well, it's true that India has been given its independence. No single achievement on the part of the Labour government has been so widely applauded throughout the world. The Indian problem, which seemed impossible of solution, has been settled on the basis of partition, the solution now proposed for Palestine. But in India, we see what such a solution may involve. For a year before India was actually divided, riot after riot broke out in the great cities where Hindus and Muslims live side by side. On August 14th and 15th, exactly a month ago, the British government transferred full powers to the new dominions of Hindustan and Pakistan. In the short time since partition, according to reliable reports, over 50,000 men, women, and children have been killed in civil warfare between Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs. The atrocities committed, their sheer savagery and cruelty, have stunned and sickened some of the most hardened observers of the late war. India's communal strife has deep historic roots. It is based on centuries of religious antagonism, long memories of aggression, economic conflict, and hatred. Now, after generations of suppression in the common cause against the British Raj, it flares up anew with all its primitive force. The immediate cause of the latest riots is the division of the 2 of the largest states into their Muslim and Hindu areas. These states are the Punjab and Bengal. The communities in the border regions are so intermingled that islands of Hindus remain in Muslim areas and vice versa, no matter how the boundaries are drawn. A mixed boundary commission has drawn the borders, and the 2 new governments have approved. Yet the people on neither side are satisfied, and their passions are roused by irresponsible leaders and a blatant nationalist press. So hundreds of thousands of people are driven from their homes. Villages are burned, sometimes with the trapped inhabitants inside. As the refugees pass through hostile territory, thousands are murdered or mutilated in unspeakable ways. The mass transfer of populations already involving about 1 million people may be tripled or quadrupled before it is finished. This, writes the Herald Tribune correspondent, is death and devastation on a scale of any but the greatest wars. It is a disaster which has turned the dream of Indian independence into a misfortune and has left the Hindu and Muslim peasants crying out for a return of the British Raj. This, of course, is no argument for the return of British rule, but it is a reminder that the role of the British Raj was a historic one, that it played a great and in many ways indispensable part in the development of modern India. In India, at any rate, independence was granted and the partition made with both sides agreeing to the solution and pledged to make it work, which probably will not be the case in Palestine. Yet in India, the responsible leaders themselves find it almost impossible to make reason prevail once passions are aroused. Mass hatred, systematically preached for years, is not easily quelled, even by those who preached it. The leaders of Hindustan and Pakistan, Nehru and Jinnah, have made joint appeals, and their governments have joined hands in trying to quell the riots, hitherto with little effect. Aged saintly Gandhi has accomplished more, in Calcutta and Delhi at least, with his spiritual appeal and his threat to fast unto death. As in India, so in the rest of Asia, the great nationalistic revolutions have roused passions and caused reigns of violence that make a mockery of the so-called peace. The leaders of these revolutions are confronted by tasks which are far more complex than the business of rousing their people to fight the British, the French, or the Dutch. Certainly these colonial powers, too, have much to answer for during the centuries they have exploited the peoples of backward regions, they have done too little to educate the natives, train them in the arts of self-government and the ways of freedom that one day was bound to be demanded. Nationalism is by no means dead. While in the United Nations we are trying to evolve the new concept of an international community, new nationalisms are rising both in the Middle East and the Far East. And even in the United Nations meetings, the claims of national sovereignty are asserted in strident tones. Our age may well figure in history as one in which the Western concepts of democracy and national independence are being spread from Europe and Asia to the rest of the world. But the corollary of these political doctrines is a new crop of nationalisms, not only in colonial areas and former subject peoples, but paradoxically in the country which professes socialism and internationalism, namely Soviet Russia. The new forces of nationalism everywhere are speeding the liquidation of empires, which is another phenomenon of our age. The breakup of empires always leaves national conflicts and seething social unrest in its wake. The breakup of the Central European empires caused disturbances in Europe, which eventually contributed to the outbreak of the Second World War. And the gradual liquidation of the British, French, and Dutch empires today is only beginning to make itself felt, causing greater instability in a politically and economically unstable world. The trouble over Palestine, the tragedy in India, Indonesia, Indochina, and even China itself are all a part of this massive social change on a world scale. Nature abhors a vacuum, and the power vacuum left by the breakup of the old empires is being filled by the United States and Soviet Russia, two compact and nearly self-sufficient continental powers occupying the heartlands of America and Eurasia. The rivalry between these two great powers is inevitable, human nature being what it is. It is accentuated, though by no means wholly determined, by the ideological cleavage between the East and the West. Ideologies, that is, political doctrines, determine the social and economic structure of nations. In international relations, they are often just media of propaganda and aggression. By means of such propaganda, of Truman doctrines, of communist-inspired political coups, etc., we and the Russians are now supposed to be fighting a Cold War or a war of nerves. Yet there is still the United Nations. In its General Assembly are represented 57 nations now, whose most fervent single wish is the prevention of all war and the building of a rule of law throughout the world. Let's look to the General Assembly, for it embodies the nearest thing to the consciences of the peoples of the world. Good night.
You have just heard Caesar Searchinger and the story behind the headlines. Mr. Searchinger is brought to you each week at this time by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Historical Association. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.